Chapter 29. When Stephen eased out the front door, he was wearing red pajamas and a gray sweatshirt. His light brown hair was mussed, his eyes blurry. The flashlight he was carrying sliced through the darkness. The babies turned toward him and froze. Their eyes glowed like little moons. Flash squealed in fear. Stephen clicked off his light, and Flash seemed to calm a bit, although he was definitely hiccuping. "Hey," Stephen whispered. "Hi," Summer whispered back. Stephen sat down next to Summer. The babies watched with interest. "Why do they come to you?" Stephen asked. "I don't know. It's like magic." "No," Summer shook his head. "I'm just quiet. They like that." Bongo flew down to Summer's shoulder. "Hello," she said to Stephen, mimicking Summer's voice. "Wow," he said. "That's amazing. Yesterday, I heard her imitate a doorbell." Stephen grinned. "She gave me this key," Summer said, holding it up. "I don't know what it's for." "A diary or a jewelry box, maybe?" "Or the world's smallest door," Stephen joked. For a while, everyone fell silent. Even the baby raccoons were still. At last, Stephen held out his hand, revealing Summer's wish. "I found this," he said. Even in the moonlight, Summer's blush was visible. She looked away. "I'm sorry about the word," Stephen said softly. "The word on the tree." "We didn't. It wasn't us." Summer nodded. "My parents aren't bad people. They are just afraid of things," Stephen shrugged. "So are mine," said Summer. "I heard my father talking about moving, if we can find a safe place to go." She gave a sad smile. "If there even is such a place." "I'm sorry," Stephen said again. The babies, sensing Stephen could be trusted, began to tussle and romp. Harold and the smallest, you reached, searched for bugs. Rose Petal and her brother. Hot buttered popcorn played tug of war with a long piece of grass. "I will miss them," Summer said. "I hope you don't move," Stephen said. A light blinked on in Stephen's house. "I should go," he said. "If my parents see me, I should go." "Night," Summer said in a whisper. "Oh, the things I wanted to say to those two. I wanted to tell them that friendship doesn't have to be hard, that sometimes we let the world make it hard. I wanted to tell them to keep talking. I wanted to make a difference, just a little difference, before I left this lovely world. And so I did it. I broke the rule. Stay," I said. Chapter 30. The animals gaped at me in astonishment. Even the youngest baby knew about the don't talk to people rule. Bongo darted to the top branch. "Red," she cried in a strangled whisper. "You can't." "Oh, but I can," I said. "What have I got to lose?" "But..." As I was saying, I returned my attention to Stephen and Summer. They were staring at me, jaws dropped, eyes wide, as frozen as Flash had been not long ago. "We are dreaming," Stephen murmured, "right?" At the same time, Summer asked, "Is that possible?" "Pinch me," Stephen said. Summer complied. Definitely felt that, Stephen reported. Maybe it was a dream pinch, Summer suggested. Excuse me, I interrupted. I have 216 rings worth of wisdom to convey and not much time. Stephen searched for Summer's hand. If it's a dream, he said, at least it's a cool one. And so I began. Chapter 31. I haven't always been a wish tree. It happened in 1848, long before I was surrounded by concrete and cars, when I was just a few decades old, still a youngster by Red Oak standards. No longer a lanky sapling, I was solid and strong, but not anchored to the earth the way I am now. This was a time, like many other times, when hungry, desperate people sailed on crowded boats to settle here. Many of them ended up, as they always seemed to, in my neighborhood. The blue and green houses were brown then and filled to overflowing with new arrivals. Sometimes the newcomers were welcomed, sometimes they were not, but still they came, hoping and wishing as people always do. One of our new residents was a young Irish girl named Maeve. She had voyaged across the Atlantic with her 19-year-old brother, who had died of dysentery during the trip. Their mother had passed away shortly after Maeve was born, their father when the children were 9 and 12. Maeve was solid and plain, but when she smiled, it was like sunshine peeking through clouds. She had a deep laugh, and her hair was as brilliantly red as my finest autumn attire. 16, alone and penniless. Maeve shared a tiny room with 5 other immigrants. She worked night and day, cleaning and cooking and doing whatever she could to stay alive. Maeve soon discovered she was gifted at caring for the sick. She had no special knowledge, no secret remedies, but she was kind and patient, and she knew how to soothe a fevered brow with a cool cloth as well as anyone. What she didn't know, she was willing to learn. As time passed, word grew of Maeve's abilities. People brought her their sick piglets and their lame horses, their coughing children, and fretful babies. Always she explained that she wasn't sure she could help, but since people in the neighborhood were too poor to go to a doctor, they turned to Maeve. And since people believed she could help them get better, Maeve tried to live up to their hopes. When she succeeded, and even when she didn't, patients and their families would leave small tokens for her. A whittled figurine of a bird, a hairpin, half a loaf of bread. One someone even left a leather-covered journal with a tiny silver key that opened its lock. When Maeve was out tending to someone who was sick, people took to leaving their thank yous in my lowest hollow. It was still a fresh wound, just a couple of seasons mended. But because it faced the house where Maeve roomed and not the street, it was a safe place to leave a token of gratitude. That's when I realized that hollows can be a good thing for people, not just birds and animals. Little did I know just how good. Chapter 32. The years passed and Maeve became as connected to the neighborhood as I was. Even as newcomers from other lands added their music and food and language to our little part of the world, no matter where people were from, Maeve cared for them as best she could. I grew tougher, my older limbs less pliable, my shadow longer. More trees and shrubs joined me. But there was plenty of sun for all of us, and we never wanted for water. I had hosted many families by then, mice and chipmunks in particular. My closest confidant was a gray, young gray squirrel named Squibbles. Squibbles was especially fond of Maeve, who often led the little squirrel table scraps. Privately, Squibbles and I worried about Maeve. Along the way, Maeve had seen a suitor or two, but nothing much came of these flirtations. She had friends aplenty and a work to do from dawn till dusk. Still, she seemed lonely. Sometimes Maeve would sit on the porch steps, watching happy families stroll past, and her eyes would well up with tears. At night, she would gaze out an open upstairs window, and her sighs would float to us on the breeze, melancholy as the call of a mourning dove. Often, Maeve would sit at the base of my trunk and write in her journal. Now and then, she would read passages aloud. She spoke about the Irish countryside fading into fog. She spoke about her family she had lost. She spoke about her secret hopes and fears and longings. She had love to give and no one to give it to. Maeve adored early mornings when the world was bathed in mist and the sun was still a promise. She would lean against my trunk and close her eyes and hum a tune from her childhood. One day, the first day of May, Maeve joined me at dawn. To my surprise, she reached up to my lowest bough and gently tied a scrap of blue striped fabric in a careful knot. "I wish," she whispered, "for someone to love with all my heart." That was my first wish and the beginning of many more.